From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on the last day of school in June when teachers said goodbye to students until September. Most of them, anyway. And it's always bittersweet, I'm sure, but this time felt a little different. Neither the teachers nor the students knew what school would look like when they see each other again. District superintendents have told us on this program they hope to conduct something that looks a lot more like pre-pandemic school, even if many kids are too young to be vaccinated. They understand the importance of having kids together in the classroom, and they know the challenge of remote learning. But New York State is still evaluating the data, COVID cases, the Delta variant, and more. The Connections team is surveying local districts on how their plans are coming together for the fall, but for now there remains a lot of uncertainty regarding exactly what school will look like 6 weeks from now. Well, this summer we're inviting teachers to tell us, what have they learned about their work during the pandemic? What approaches have worked? What new ideas should remain long after a pandemic? What hasn't worked? What lessons should we take from all of this going forward? I'd like to welcome our guests now. Evie Fanning is a local high school English teacher. Evie, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
On the line with us is Megan Harris, a special education teacher in the Rochester City School District. Welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And Olivia Niebuhr is a 7th grade special education teacher at the Greece Central School District. Olivia, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Evan. I'm happy to be here.
I'm going to ask all three of you for some general thoughts here. And parents, if you want to share your thoughts on what has worked, what's worked for your kids, what do you want to see change? You know, was this sort of a were there blessings that have come from all of this, or was it all a struggle? 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections at wxxi.org. Evie Fanning, you've been teaching for a number of years now. The
Indeed.
Last 15 months have been the greatest of your career, the hardest of your career, the most rewarding, or 15 months you never want to do again.
I don't know that I'd want to repeat it. It was interesting, but I don't want to say it was the greatest challenge I've encountered in my teaching career either, as teachers were always adjusting. So there's always something being thrown at you. You always have to think on your feet. This was a different kind of challenge, to be sure. But it was something that I think I was prepared for.
What was the hardest part of the last 15 months or so?
No doubt the hardest part was that I saw each of my students for 80 minutes a week and I only saw half of their face. So it's really,
half of their face?
No, masks, right?
Oh, well,
so,
yeah.
So, and I teach English, so I think, you know, working with language, body language is part of it, and facial expressions and everything else, and just the ability to connect with a student, I think is essential to teaching. So I have to be able to form a relationship so that we respect each other, because otherwise, why would they take me seriously, right? And why would they want to learn from me? So that was tough. It was hard to connect to students this past year compared to other years when we have more time together.
Mm-hmm. Megan Harris, what about you? What have the last 15, 16 months been like for you?
Well, I mean, I have to agree that the connecting with students was difficult. One of the things that RCSD did that was really helpful to the beginning of the school year was to work in social emotional learning time. So we had a 20-minute period of time every morning, and as a special education teacher, my own caseload were the students that I worked with. So we had 20 minutes where it was just myself and a handful of students. I think that was beneficial. Obviously, it does not take the place of in-person connections with students, but I did appreciate that time, and I felt like when that time had to be taken away because we went to some remote and some hybrid, and the way the scheduling had to work, we had to lose the SEL time, as we called it. Mm-hmm. And when I spoke to kids at the end of the school year and a few parents, one of the things that they said they appreciated the most was that time. And it was kind of hard to tell. I do 7th and 8th grade. I'm integrated co-teaching, which means that I teach with a general education teacher in the classroom with a large group of students. And I felt like it was kind of hard to connect because I think, as was just stated, kids don't, they're hiding behind their mask if you're in person. But when you're online, most of these students don't feel comfortable putting their face on Zoom.
Turning the camera on?
Yeah, and even though at the beginning which meant the previous school year when we all left in March, there was this discussion about requiring students to, you know, have their faces on. I know some of my friends and colleagues who work in the lower grades didn't have as much of a problem. Some of the littler guys would definitely be happy to, like, dance around and have their face. But I think as you get to the older grades, intermediate, middle school, high school, most students did not feel comfortable and probably felt kind of in the spotlight. So that made it a little difficult. Some of the kids I had never met. So you know, you've got seventh graders that are brand new to our building, but you've never seen them because they've never showed their face. So some of it was trying to connect on other levels, maybe pulling kids into a virtual breakout room and trying to connect with them that way and work with them that way. I happened to be fully remote the whole year and due to some medical issues. So I was home, and my colleagues, when we went back in February to hybrid, I had colleagues that were in the building, but I ran the remote portion. And that actually worked out well for other teachers and some of my colleagues in my building. So I took a resource room with all remote kids, and then my kids that I had that were in person went to a teacher that went to in person. So they weren't trying to teach both in person and remotely at the same time. That was probably the most difficult part from what my colleagues had said. I did not myself experience that because I was fully remote, but I know that that was a difficulty. But I did all the remote stuff. I monitored the chat. I monitored the students that were online. I answered the questions as they came in so that the students that were in person were being monitored and spoken to by the teacher that was in person. And then we would try to collaborate together. Or it was good for bird's eye view for me. I would say to, you know, oh, we can't hear that question because a lot of kids aren't going to speak up also at that age. Or, oh, we can't hear that video. And so I can't imagine when I've spoken to other colleagues and said, you know, is that going on in your class? I'm like, oh, you know what? I don't know, because they're not remote. So they're not seeing what the remote kids see. So I know for some kids it was beneficial. There are kids that did do well and, you know, made good grades. I have my own child who is also a middle school student who didn't do well. So I saw from my own aspect that my child stayed home until the last marking period, and he really struggled. And he needs to be in person, but, you know, we waited until there was a vaccine, and we waited until, you know, we felt it was safe. So, I mean, you're balancing the safety of your child, both in your own classroom and in your own home, versus what do we do with, you know, education. And I think I'd said last time when I was on your program that this would be the opportunity to reimagine education. And I don't know, I haven't really seen that. That's a little disappointing to me.
Yeah, we're going to talk.
Look like Adam,
yeah, we're going to talk about that coming up here. But what that actually would mean from all of your perspectives, Olivia, what's it been like for you?
So complicated for sure is the first word that comes to mind. I teach special education as well, but I teach self-contained, meaning that I have 12 students with me most of the day. I teach them all four core subjects. But because of the way Greece was set up, I had students who were remote. I had students who came to school 4 days a week, and I had some students that only came to school 2 days a week all at the same time. So it was really difficult to juggle my remote students, you know, my students that were there Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, and then my students that were only there Tuesday, Friday, remembering, you know, who was there for what lesson, making sure I had copies for kids that weren't present but were online, making sure I had everything posted online. The organization was just like a huge mind like game, basically. So that was really difficult for sure. And I think that my students, they had a hard time with the, you know, the masking in schools. They had a hard time, you know, understanding why they couldn't, you know, eat lunch in my room or things like that, different rules that came about. I knew they really struggled with that. And so that was something that we really dealt with the entire year.
Now, when it comes to the question of how you make sure students are engaged, I already have an email. Jeremy says, I'm surprised that you can't require cameras to be on. How else are teachers supposed to know if kids are engaged?
I have to say, even with the cameras on, you know, they've got multiple screens open. They've got video games going. I mean, I've just asked them, you know, when you're in a Zoom class, let's say you have the camera on, how much attention are you paying? Would you say that you are you are paying attention to me 100% of the time or none of the time. And it was below half for most of them. And most of them have other windows open and have other things
going on. Even when the cameras
on.
Are on. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So even if you could require the cameras to be on, that's no guarantee that you're getting participation or engagement.
No, it turns out it isn't.
It's tough. Is that
the
how...
The other thing, too...
Yeah.
The other thing, too, about the cameras is that you don't know what students are doing at home. They might be babysitting a younger sibling because their parents are at work. Especially in the upper grades, we were told to be very sensitive to those home lives.
Mm-hmm.
They might not have a quiet room to go to with no distractions in the background, right? So there's a lot of other reasons kids might not have their cameras on. For sure, the majority probably could turn them on. But I agree, it doesn't necessarily automatically mean engagement. My school and other schools as well have tools where we can see what they're doing on their computer, on their Chromebook, even when they're at home during a class. And those tools are more helpful in seeing how engaged they are than just having their camera on in a class. But that makes sense that that question would come up.
Yeah. And so, Jeremy, I hope that helps here. I'm hearing from adjunct professor. I just heard from an adjunct professor, Joel at MCC, says they can't require it either. I'm sure there's a limitation to engagement when you can't be in person, but let me ask all three of you, and Evie, I'll start with you. I mean, if you are really reimagining or at least taking lessons forward here, I don't know if most teachers are just eager to quote unquote get back to pre-pandemic school as fast as possible, or if you're sitting here going, this is a huge opportunity, and if we miss this, we will never get it again. Is there an opportunity, and if so, what is it to reimagine?
Oh, absolutely. There are so many things that I've learned from this. Stuff that maybe, you know, I had considered before and found out that, yes, it does or no, it doesn't work. But also things that I had never thought about before that just, you know, we were forced to deal with this time. And so now we know. My favorite thing about this kind of learning was the de-emphasis on grades. So I think, you know, what was essential changed to pandemic essential, and things that we used to require maybe got a little bit more flexible, and we were more understanding and more aware of the different challenges that are getting in the way, and so had to adjust the expectations, had to adjust our objectives, and had to adjust the grading. And I think the grades became much less important. And I really realized that I think that's really great. I loved that. I hope we can take that with us going forward. I think there traditionally is too much emphasis on them. I think that they are often pretty arbitrary. I don't know how useful they are either to the teacher or to the student. I've learned that life without them is better.
So let me push on two aspects of this. One is one of the arguments for grades, for more standardized tests, for continuing that sort of structure and system, is that how do you as a teacher know if your students have learned something? And the second is, this is how society is. It's competitive. You have to be prepared for a competitive world, a working world, and grades and tests are a way to prepare. So can you engage with both of those?
Oh, absolutely. I'd love to. The first question... Remind me, which one was first?
How do you know as a teacher?
How do I know?
If someone's learning.
Who is better positioned than the teacher to know whether or not the student has met the objective? Certainly not whoever wrote the test who has never met my students, I think. So as a teacher, as somebody who has set the objective, has planned the lesson, and has engaged with the student, I know whether or not they're ready to move on. And whether that's through... you know, a piece of writing or a test or a conversation or a group discussion, basically, I don't need to know whether they're at an 86 or an 82. And frankly, I don't know the difference between an 86 and an 82 when it comes to...
Or an 86 and 85, right?
I mean, really,
or an 80
yeah,
or
many
79.
Of them. That, I, when kids ask me, why did I get an 86, I don't have much to say. So I think, you know, we need... The 100-point system makes very little sense to me. And I think that the 65 as a passing grade is kind of arbitrary also, because that needs to be adjusted depending on the task. So maybe if you read a book and you retain 65% of it, that's passing. Cool. You got it. You know what's going on. But if you need to convey something, if you need to write something and explain yourself and get somebody to understand you, 65% is not enough. Right? We need to be able to be heard and to be understood. So when you're writing a paper, when you're writing an essay, when you have something to say, I'm not going to consider you done with that task until you're much higher than a 65.
It's interesting you say that, because the first thing that comes to mind for me is, if you were an electrician going to electrician school and you were succeeding 65% of the time, no one should hire you. If you're right. a doctor, if you're a surgeon, 65% is probably not sufficient for the public health. But so
I think sometimes
depending
it
on the
is.
Task, right. Depending on the task, depending on what we're asking.
Right.
But you're saying the teacher should have the discretion to say, this is an A, or this is passing, this is an issue, this is not good enough.
So that kind of takes me to the second part, the competitive. If our objective is to rank students, then okay, we need grades. But if our objective is to teach students, then we need to focus on that.
And there's a difference.
I think so. I think if I have an objective, I want my student to understand something, I want them to gain this skill. Then I'm going to focus on them gaining that skill, not making sure that the kid next to them gained it at 2% better than they did or worse than they did. So I think the important thing for me is, you know, have I gotten them to where I need them to be? And that's a pass-fail system, really. Like, until you get there, we need to keep working on it. And once you've gotten there, we can move on. And that's that.
You don't need 77 or 79 or 81.
I personally don't, and I find it difficult to justify those distinctions. I have personal children in my home that I, you know, try to teach how to live their lives. And I try to think about that when I plan my teaching. And I think when I teach my kids something that I really want them to know, I really want them to understand it, would I ever grade them? Hmm. And no, I absolutely never do. You know, I don't quiz them either.
And like on a 100-point scale.
Yeah. You know, either I say, awesome, good job, or I explain it again differently.
Okay. And so before I turn to Olivia and Megan for their thoughts on what we can really take forward, I think the question that must be asked in tandem with this is there any chance that your hope for a reimagining school system, whether it's in your building, in your district, or sort of society-wide, is there a chance that we're going to be less grade obsessed, test obsessed, et cetera?
I really hope so. And I think we're starting to see movement in that direction. You know, there are prestigious universities that are no longer looking at SAT scores, for example. And, you know, there's research that says grades are not indicative of skills. You know, we all know that there are students who quote, succeed and get very good grades and are not learning much besides how to play the game.
Yeah, how to test well.
Right.
As opposed to what are they actually retaining and learning that is applicable and useful.
Yeah, so I hope that it is realistic. Not anytime soon, probably, or not entirely.
I mean, do you have colleagues who talk about this? Is this something that comes up?
Yeah, sure. It's not a popular opinion because we're resistant to change, right? This is how it's always been. There's always been a lottery. This is always how it's been done. This is how we went to school. And so this is what we're comfortable with. But, you know, I always try to come back to what is the objective? What are we trying to accomplish?
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that the system, the 100-point system and the 65% benchmark of where you pass is achieving our objective.
Yeah, there's a lot of inertia. I mean, elections are always on Tuesdays and work weeks are five days for the last 100 years.
Yeah, we want to keep things where they are. The alternative to get it done a lot faster is we just put me in charge of everything. Philosopher queen.
Okay, well, I am curious to know as we go throughout the hour, if listeners want to share thoughts on, are we moving in a direction of not obsessing over grades, especially 100-point scale? Are we going to do that differently? And is this an open door to change that? Olivia Niebuhr, what is top of mind for you? If we're going to reimagine education, What's the opportunity that's in front of us right now?
I think that learning how to use technology in a way that still engages students and gets us to the point where we can know them through that was a huge thing that we learned this year. I think most teachers would say they would rather have their kids in front of them, absolutely. But like we heard earlier, some kids did really well online. And I feel bad kind of taking that away from them again, especially some kids who did better online. And truly did better, not just kind of cheated the system or whatever. But, you know, learning how to use technology, I became much more proficient in Google Classroom this year, as well as my students. And a lot of times, you know, I didn't take an online class until I was, you know, in late college. And we're having these young students learn how to take online classes, learn how to do things online. And I do think that that will prepare them for the future and for their, you know, professional life a lot better than I was, right? You know, I did things online a lot more than I was ready to in college and beyond. And so learning how to use those tools effectively, learning how to be on a computer without being super distracted, I think those are skills that our kids are learning. And I would hate to see that go away completely because they're going to have access to computers and phones in the real world. You know, they're not going to be told to put them away the same way as we do in schools. And so I would like to see that, you know, internet etiquette continue. And I agree with what was said before about grades as well. I think that, you know, there was a lot less pressure. We were able to be a lot more flexible this year, and that made our teaching better because we could focus on who our students were in front of us, to work on trying to engage the students that were on the screen. And it gave us a little bit of a breath, a little bit of space to say, you know what, I'm going to forego this lesson today, and instead I'm going to focus on this because this is what my students need. And I just felt more freedom to do that this year.
Yeah, I will say, Olivia, I'm someone who could use some education on how to use computers effectively and mm-hmm. remain focused. I have so many tabs up in an internet. The tabs on the left side of my screen are these lonely tabs that are looking, that every morning they look at me and they're like, you promised you would read me. This is an article that you left up on the, you promised you would get to this. And I always say, I will get mm-hmm. to you, I promise. And then what happens is when I start engaging in like actual work, then I go, I should get to those tabs now. And I'm always distracted. Mm-hmm. There's always something that mm-hmm. can take my attention away. But I do think there's an actual skill of mm-hmm. remaining focused, of understanding how you can use technology in a way that doesn't distract from a task or supplements learning as opposed to just doing it for you. So I think that that would be beautiful. But Olivia, are you an optimist that we can sort of create an educational system that does impart those lessons?
I am optimistic that we can do that only because I've heard a lot of teachers this year say, well, I put everything on Google Classroom this year, I'm going to keep doing that in the future. I think a lot of teachers streamlined their material to be electronic, and so there is intention to continue that moving forward because there is some benefits to us as teachers, especially when it comes to grading, being able to see things remotely, things like that. So I am hopeful. I don't know that it'll become, you know, the norm for everyone, but I'm hopeful that I'm more hopeful for the technology change than I am for the grading change. I agree with both, but I really do think that people got used to it this year and saw there are certain ways that it can make their lives easier. And I'm hopeful that it can change. But at the same time, like you said, Evan, us as teachers also had to learn how to use our computers effectively and how to not get distracted. So we have to learn it first and then be able to teach our students.
Mm-hmm. Megan Harris, what is a way to reimagine education that is lasting and takes this opportunity and uses it wisely?
Well, I think everybody's kind of stated it, but to put it in some other terms, the idea of the grading, and for those of us in special education, I also taught self-contained for a number of years and understand, you know, the need to not only teach the content, but also making sure that, you know, we're differentiating for those students. And I think what I saw happen, because I was teaching self-contained when we first, you know, left the school in March and then went into the integrated co-teaching this year. So having those two perspectives, the idea is to have students meet standards, you know, or be able to master a skill. You know, I really think that grades are arbitrary. I think that they're very subjective, and some teachers you'll hear, oh, they grade so hard, and oh, they're such an easy grader. You know, to me, it sounds like students need to master certain skills. If we're looking for a mastery of a skill, it also may look different between this group of students and this group of students. You know, I know I teach in a bigger district than the other two guests, and when I think of the seventh graders that come in to me, they could be coming from tens of different schools, you know, and every teacher has a subjective way maybe of looking at their grading or a subjective way that they're imparting the knowledge that they're sharing with students. So when they're coming to me, I need to look at where are they on that mastery. You know, did they grasp the ability to write a full sentence, a full paragraph, or an essay? You know, there's a lot of different skills that we do need to teach, that students do need to leave high school with. But I also think that not all students learn the same. And I know that your other guests on the show will understand what this means, and other educators. You know, students have different vehicles of learning. Some students who are very auditory and they can take in information, those are the kids who say, oh, they're such sponges, right? They hear everything we say and they can repeat back to you and they can engage in conversation because they're really understanding everything that's being spoken around them. Some kids are very visual. Some kids need to get their hands in. We call them kinesthetic learners. They need to get their hands on something. Those are the kids that excel in labs or, you know, maybe in an art class or music class. So when you're looking at how kids learn, this is where I feel like it's, I think it's grades. I think grades are not a great way to measure. I will speak about myself. I was not a great student. I share this with my students at times. I'm a graduate of RCSC. It was no fault of my teachers because I had amazing teachers, but the way that traditional school was taught did not fit with my ability to show the mastery of what I've learned or what I know. And having gone to school and graduating in the 80s, you know, that was very, you know, you sit at your desk, this is the assignment, you do it, you spit out the work, teacher slaps a grade on it, and there you go. You know, could they tell that I mastered the skill? I have no idea.
Yep.
You know, I was turning in stuff to get the grade to be ranked at a certain, you know, position in my high school at graduation so I could go on to college, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I'm thinking I'm not a big proponent of standardized testing. I think that teachers, I definitely know where my kids are. I can tell you during any point in the year what students need to work on, you know, what students are struggling, what students are excelling, who's mastering this, who's, you know, who's not mastering this. I know this intuitively because I'm working, even though I was remote, and there are lots of different vehicles for us. Again, you know, we can look at online. We used Google as well. We did it so that when we assigned assignments, I could literally watch students working while they were working. And when we were in a classroom situation, this would be a for instance, we would assign this assignment, you know, you have 28 students, maybe 10 of them are students with special needs. And what I would do is I would start with the students with special needs and I might go in and look at what they're doing. And then I might private message, hey, great job. I see that you're doing really well on number three, keep going. Then I might see a student hasn't even started. And then I send a little message, hey, what's going on? It might be, oh, my computer is not working, or I don't know where the assignment is. That happened a lot. And I might pull students to then go over again, because some students do need directions repeated multiple times. They need it shown to them. You know, these kids are home. A lot of my students were home, even the kids with special needs that I was working with in classes. So I might have to pull a student into a room and go over two or three times, how do you find this assignment? Then what do you do on the assignment? So, you know, we're assuming, I feel like our educational system in the United States, I'm going to generalize, even though I know there are pockets of great, you know, education and lots of supportive teachers. But I think a lot of the times we fit everybody in one box, and that's what grading does. Mm-hmm. That's what standardized testing does. Everybody has to hit the mark. If you don't hit the mark, then you're not going to be successful. And again, being that student who had great teachers, you know, I engaged with my teachers. I engaged with my peers. I understood the material. I just was not, you know, loving school in the academic sense. It was, it was hard for me to understand in my own mind the stuff that I was spitting back out to the teacher, you know, how that was going to, you know, reconcile in a grade, right? That was just how my brain worked.
And don't
so
you,
I just did the bare minimum and I got through.
And I
got
to say, I mean, I think that, it's not even that it's a secret. It's just that I don't think that we think often enough about how addicted to scoring everything we are. And the problem, the danger is we attach a permanence to it. So, you know, just as an example of something that is ridiculous to put numbers on, you know, I've written about wine for years. This wine is 93 points. What does that what does that mean to anybody?
Nothing.
It means the secret is it means nothing, and yet it moves millions of consumer dollars because we attach a permanence to just a bottle of a beverage. We put numbers on everything. We score video games.
Yeah.
We score literature. We Everything gets a number. And
because that's how people are. People need to label.
Or they feel like that's how they can guide like their decisions. Yeah. And to Megan's point, we are doing that to our kids in a system in which different teachers will tell you, well, I grade on a curve. Well, I don't. I'm a harder grader. Right. I'm an easier grader. But we will look at that kid and be like, that kid is an 84. That kid's a 92. Evie?
At the very end, when we graduate them, we graduate them with a GPA, right? Like there's a number attached that goes on all of your applications, that goes on all of your records. And as it turns out, that is a terrible predictor of college success. Literally, the GPA doesn't tell us that much. Specific scores to standardized tests tell us even less. So I'm not sure who we're doing this for.
It's a bad system.
Whom is it benefiting?
Yeah. Go ahead, Megan.
Yeah, and I think sometimes it also, and again, I'm going to go back to special education because I know for many years, I'm almost on my 20th year in teaching, and I've seen this change, and I don't know if it was just at my building or just in our district, but I remember when I first started out, I taught self-contained for 16 years, and the reason why that's important is because I was driving everything in my classroom. I was the one who was planning, teaching, scoring, everything. In the integrated co-teaching, I'm speaking to a colleague and we're talking to each other and making decisions. So all these years making my own decisions, I had a colleague who said to me once, why don't you differentiate your grading? And I was like, what? What do you mean differentiate my grading? Because what had happened in the city school district, we cannot grade below a certain percentage, even if the kids had earned. That doesn't matter, an F is an F. But they were kind of standardizing our grading. And I thought about how if I had a student with an intellectual disability, because in the 12-1-1 setting, which is what I taught, which I think is what one of your other guests teaches, Olivia, right?
Mm-hmm.
We could get a number of, and I don't know how it does in Greece, but I know I could get a student with autism. I could get a student who's intellectually disabled. I could get a kid with a learning disability. So I would have kids on two ends of the educational spectrum, so to speak. And my intellectually disabled student who really struggles academically because they just, you know, they just don't have the cognitive ability to reach that A. Is it really fair to fail that student? Because the only thing that I had in front of me was what I could work with. So I had to, you know, think outside the box for the student. How do I teach the student as much as I can? And then in the meantime, trying to find a program that's more appropriate because we don't have BOCES in the city and trying to figure out a way that they're going to learn skills because that's what they need. They needed skill-based learning. But then I've got maybe, you know, an autistic student or, you know, an emotionally disturbed student who is brilliant academically. I want to say that specifically, who can, you know, bring those straight A's in. And this academic stuff is just, you know, that's not where their learning is. Their learning curve is the social emotional piece or maybe, you know, those kind of things. So, you know, when you're looking at that in that microcosm of a self-contained, you can apply that to the bigger classroom, whether it's a special education class or not. Some students are very social. That might be all that they're, you know, maybe that's what they're best at. They're, you know, they're social interactions with peers or social interactions with teachers, but maybe like academics aren't really that important to them, but maybe because they're lacking in a skill of writing. You know, they're really good at, you know, they're an orator, but they're not good at writing. You might get a student, you know what I'm saying? Like there's so many different levels of skills that need to be taught to a number of different kids. And I think the reimagined education is to meet every student where they are and not assume that everybody has to start off at the same time of the year, you know, in the fall, like, oh, everybody must have got everything they needed this year.
Well, certainly the students are all coming to you from different places anyway. And so I've got to get our only break of the hour in here. I'm seeing that in some ways this conversation has been dominated by grading, but maybe it should be. I mean, maybe we need to have a whole separate conversation about, especially the people who are in positions of power to make these decisions and say, are you happy with this? Because we're hearing from parents, et cetera. Now, I do have a little bit of pushback directed at something Evie said, which we'll get after this break. I've got a little bit of pushback directed at something Olivia said. We'll get there. And then I've got a couple of other emails I want to read on some other subjects. Because what we aim to do this summer is talk to a wide range of teachers about their experiences during the pandemic and what they think the lessons ought to be going forward. Where do we go next in education? And do we just want to go back, so to speak? Or is this a chance to say, no, we've learned too much to do it exactly as we used to? Evie Fanning is a local high school English teacher with us in studio. Megan Harris, a special education teacher in the RCSD. Olivia Niebuhr, a seventh grade special education teacher in Greece. And we're right back to your feedback for them next. Coming up in our second hour, the city of Rochester is launching a new composting pilot program. We're talking about who's eligible, and our guests will answer your questions about home composting, what you can and can't compost, how much is too much, how much would be too little when it comes to greens or leaves or coffee grounds. Everything composting, next hour.
This is Veronica Volk from WXXI News, and we've got a new weekly podcast for you. It's called Earshot, and it's got all the most important, best told, sometimes off the beaten path news stories from your favorite WXXI and city reporters. Earshot comes out every Friday. Don't miss it. Subscribe wherever you find your podcasts.
This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let me preface this next part of the conversation by saying I'm getting a lot of feedback from people who are really digging the idea of changing the way we evaluate students, grades, number grades, the number of standardized tests that teachers have to administer and the time that that takes. So there's a lot of thumbs up for that. And I don't know if this is just sort of a selective sample of Connections listeners, but I'm sure there is plenty of pushback because we do it this way. I mean, like this, we've been grading like this for a long time. So here's from a listener who sent a note to the Connections email, and it comes from a cell phone, and I'm only saying the cell phone, so I don't have a name attached to this. But this person writes, as a student, growing up, I always found numerical grades useful because I knew that this is how well I did for the amount of effort I put into it and could develop confidence in my abilities based on those number scores. Evie, so that's a pushback to what you said there. What do you think?
Sure. There are lots of kids who like getting the grades. Incidentally, they happen to be the kids that get the good grades. But I think that that's just a habit, right? Like an 82 doesn't mean anything. It really doesn't. I may as well grade you platypus or armadillo or purple, you know, whatever. It really has nothing to do with what you have learned and whether or not you have learned it. I think there are much more meaningful ways to give students feedback, whether that's through a conversation or through a note or through, you know, if it's an assignment that's not a straight test, maybe it's something that has some give and take or has some collaboration, and you get your confidence and you get your feedback that way in a more natural, more real sense.
Okay. And Jen writes to say, no technology at all. That should be the lesson. It was all too much for kids and they tuned out. So, Olivia, that's different than what you said. Let's use technology in ways that is effective, that doesn't allow for distraction, that allows for real learning supplements. But Jen says, no, get rid of all technology and learning lessons. That should be the lesson from the pandemic. What would you say to Jen?
Yeah, I mean, I understand that it was overwhelming. Absolutely. It was overwhelming to students. It was overwhelming to teachers. And I think it was very overwhelming for parents. They don't know what Seesaw is. They don't know what, you know, Google Meets are. They don't know. Right, exactly. Like, they don't know any of those stuff. Those words that we say that is like a teaching language and student language, parents were super confused as well. So I understand that it was overwhelming. We very much felt that way. I saw a lot of teachers and students, you know, have tears over, you know, technology failures or technology complications. So I get the feeling to just get rid of it and go back to how it was. I will say, though, that the rest of the world isn't doing that. So my point in saying that technology was beneficial this year was only because I really do think it is helping prepare our students for the world beyond. And it's really hard to find a job nowadays that doesn't use technology in some type of way. And you know, kind of going off of what Megan was saying, especially when working with students with disabilities, you know, we are focusing on giving them skills that will help them be successful long term. You know, we aren't focusing on making sure they get an A. We're focusing on making sure that they are going to have marketable skills and be successful in their future, however they want to pursue it. And I think technology is just becoming a huge part of that. And if you are afraid of the feeling of feeling overwhelmed and being fearful, it does cause you to want to shut it out and say no more. But unfortunately, I just don't really see that in the working world where people are doing that.
Okay, let me ask Evie and Megan about technology. Evie, briefly on technology, what would you say to Jen, who says that should be the lesson? It was too much. No technology in learning.
I'm leaning a little bit towards Jen. I absolutely see what Olivia is saying. We need to be technologically literate. I don't think there's any danger of our students not having achieved that. I think that they get lots of technology. And like she said, we can't avoid it in their lives, in their school, in their whatever it is they're doing. They're surrounded by technology. I find students very comfortable with it, you know, and often in position to teach me about it. But also, that's not all we're teaching them. You know, when I teach literature, I want them to read a book on paper.
It matters to you.
It matters to me. And I would love to go into the research that I've done about why it's a completely different process neurologically than reading on a screen.
Oh, that's interesting.
But that's can we do that tomorrow?
That's really interesting.
Yeah, I want them reading on paper. I want them writing with a pen. There are different processes. And I want lots of conversation. I want lots of face-to-face. I think that for kids especially, again, it's a different behavior, and it's a different process, and it's a different kind of learning. So we need to learn about technology. We don't necessarily need to spend that much time learning through technology. I think that we learn from teachers. I got some really great advice my senior year in high school, and I find myself thinking back to it often. One of my teachers said, when you're in college, if there's a great professor, you take that class. It does not matter what he or she is teaching. It doesn't matter if it's basket weaving or whatever. If it's a great professor, take that class and you're going to learn. And it has proven so true. So I think that, I think we need teachers in front of students. I think we need relationships and connections between people. And I think really that's how we learn best, I think.
Okay. Megan Harris, what do you think?
I agree with both. And I also agree that the technology is overwhelming. I think what the mistake might have been is that, well, we weren't prepared for a pandemic. So, you know, what do? We know everybody has to be remote. If we recall, right at the beginning, when we all left the building, we were still teaching, but we have to teach students in their homes. We have to teach students with technology. So I think what parents were seeing, and I know I saw it because the district that my son is in is definitely, they were using different stuff than I use. And I was having to learn the two systems his district was using. I had to learn the multiple systems I was using. And I think what became frustrating is that there was like this revolving door of, you know, oh, here's a new program. Let's try this. Here's a new program. Let's try this. And I think we all just got exhausted over technology. However, with that being said, and again, going back to whether it's special education students or not, you know, having students, I had a student, actually I had a couple of students who writing for them is very difficult. So we can't remove this vehicle for them to express themselves in, say, an English class when, you know, they have to write even just a paragraph. You know, some students definitely excel better in writing. I've had students who said, I don't really like the computer. Can I just handwrite my essay? Absolutely. I am not going to say no. But then I have other students who are like, my writing is just so complicated to read. Can I just use the computer? Absolutely. That's what I was kind of saying before the break, is that we have to work with kids where they are, whether it means using some technology and some, you know, more antiquated systems. I'm all for the antiquated systems too, because I do find that a lot of, I do also like to read books that are actually books.
I call them classic systems, not antiquated.
All right. Classics, as I call them, antiquated. All right, classic systems. You know, where you do want to put the book in a kid's hand where they can maybe learn how to, you know, take notes in the margins. But you can also do that online. So I think sometimes we think so linearly, right? We just think this is the way it's always been. I know we've said this already. This is the way it's got to be. but we have all these really great programs. There are certain things you just can't teach for kids to get the picture in their mind. If you have a very visual student, and I'll use math as an example, having taught multiple subjects or sometimes science, when you need to show a kid something that you cannot recreate within your classroom space or from home, for that matter, you have to have some type of technology to show that. Showing how volcanoes work, right? I mean, that's just part of a seventh grade curriculum we've done. And, you know, showing how tectonic plates move. You know, these are things that I can't recreate in any way, shape, or form. Having that technology and allowing those kids that need that visual, that need to be able to see, oh, okay, that's what that looks like.
And let me just jump in, maybe, because I've got to get to calls and emails, but just briefly, I think what you're saying when it comes to tectonic plates and stuff is probably different than literature. So technological application may be different subject to subject.
Yeah.
You know, and but maybe not a one size fits all for tech across the board.
Absolutely.
Every
not.
Classroom. Because I hear Jen's email, and I have felt that myself, and I can relate. Let me just try to weave in a couple quick comments here. James in Brighton. Go ahead, James.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
My comment would be that, you know, one of the ways that we better prepare a parent to teach or help their kids with technology is that, you know, that parent would have taken those classes when they were a child. And that's traditionally how it's been, you know, with mathematics and stuff like that. I mean, algebra doesn't change, and you can help your kid learn algebra because you took it. But if the parent has no idea how to work the technology, then they can't help the child, and then frustration ensues. So we can say, okay, well, we'll start teaching it now. That way, by the time a child who's taken technology and learned it throughout their life, they can help their kids learn the technology at home. My only comment would be is at some point, you know, when does technology flatline out and not change so much that when the parent goes to teach their kid what they learned about technology, it's different. It's already changed. So yeah. It's a strong endeavor.
Yeah, man. Listen, that is so true. I mean, I think Evie, you said something along the lines of you learned from your students in some ways on this.
Oh, I learned from my elementary and middle school personal children.
But that's got to be difficult for parents who already feel like I don't know the subject, and now I don't know the tech either.
Well, I gotta say, I don't know the math they're doing anymore either. I mean, that does change, right? Has anybody else seen this? It's the Common Core math. It does things in a completely different way. It's really interesting. I'm enjoying learning it from my kids, but no, everything is different. And I think trust your teachers to know what they're doing and to present the information in a way that is meaningful to the student, that doesn't feel like doing monkey tricks on tight ropes, you know, make it relevant. You know, there are pictures in books too. And people learned without Zoom for a very long mm-hmm. time, and they didn't learn any less than we did. And there are, you know, back to objectives. I know it might be getting boring, but why are we teaching them all this stuff? In the end of the day, what is it that we're trying to instill in them? And it's things like empathy and kindness and awareness and understanding. And those things, I don't think that those things come from learning Seesaw.
Yeah, and let me just ask Olivia to kind of add to that here. If you were changing the curriculum, do you care more, Olivia, about whether seventh graders can do certain math or science skills or chemistry, or do you think it's more important that they understand how to look at the label of a shirt, understand where it was made, and understand the labor conditions and the people who might have been affected by that? I mean, like, what are we actually teaching? Would you redesign it, Olivia?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I don't know. I guess I'd say for me, like, I agree with, you know, the idea that we should be teaching empathy and, you know, relationships and things like that. And so in your example, I would want them to look at a label of a shirt and understand the working conditions of the people that made it. I'm a social studies teacher, you know, originally, so I also feel very strongly about that kind of stuff. But I do, you know, I see value in the math and science that we're giving them as well. And at the middle school level, especially, you know, when you have kids say, why are we learning this? You know, some of it for sure, like, are they ever going to come across a volcano? Maybe not. But, you know, are they learning skills in learning about volcanoes? Absolutely. They're learning how to read graphs. They're learning how to understand charts and things like that. And so I don't know. I mean, I think that's a difficult question overall. Obviously, I want kids that are, you know, going to be lifelong learners. So mm-hmm. my goal is to teach students to love learning and to always be willing to learn. A lot of kids don't hate learning. They hate school. And to, you know, teach kids how to differentiate that, especially in a special education setting where students have, you know, in the past failed multiple times, you know, giving them that love of learning is really important to me. So for me, it depends on the student for sure.
Well, we're down to about our last 80 seconds or so here. So one of the things we've been focused on is whether any of this matters. Maybe 30 seconds apiece. Keep it tight here. Evie Fanning, is anything going to change meaningfully come September?
Yeah, absolutely. You can't unlearn stuff. We've seen it. We've seen what works, and we've seen the effects of that change. And so we're going to, people are going to demand it. Parents are going to demand it. Why wouldn't we do things that work better for students?
That's a sort of an optimistic note.
Surprising for me, you're right. I worry that we are dangerously close to creating efficient consumers rather than thinking intelligent people. Mm. And I want to really, you know, laser focus. Sorry.
Yep.
On that.
15 seconds, Olivia Niebuhr. In September, is anything going to change meaningfully?
Absolutely. I think that students have changed the way they think. Teachers have changed the way we think. And there's going to be lasting change from that. I don't know what it's going to look like, but I am hopeful that it will be good.
I don't know that I thought you were all going to say this. Megan, about 15, 20 seconds. Do you agree?
All right. I hope so. I'm a little bit more hesitant to believe that things are going to change that quickly. But I hope that students' voices, I hope that they're the ones that make the noise in getting some of these changes made.
I don't know. I'm usually a skeptic on this, but I think the point that we've all learned too much and seen too much to go exactly back. We'll see. This has been one of a series of conversations with teachers, and there will be more this summer. I want to thank them for being here. Evie Fanning, a local high school English teacher, thank you for making time.
Thank you so much, Evan.
Megan Harris, a teacher in the Rochester City School District. Thank you, Megan.
Thank you.
And Olivia Niebuhr, teacher in the Greece Central School District. Thank you, Olivia.
Thanks for having me.
More connections coming up in a moment.